On this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, we hear the story about how Shoalwater Bay Indian Tribe along the Washington coast worked with various partners to build the first tsunami vertical evacuation structure in the United States. Hey everyone, this is Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast, where we explore the world to bring you stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. On this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, we have a conversation with Quentin Swanson, council chairman and tribal education director of Shoalwater Bay Indian Tribe in southwestern Washington state along the Pacific coast. After seeing the devastating impacts of the 2011 Japan earthquake and tsunami, the Shoalwater Bay Indian Tribe realized they needed to prepare their community for an event like this and worked with numerous partners to build the first tsunami vertical evacuation structure in the United States. Hey, everyone, this is going to be an exciting conversation with Quentin Swanson. Don't forget to subscribe, like, and follow our content online, on social media, on your favorite podcast platform. Your support of our channel helps us ensure that we can do many more episodes of the GeoTrek podcast in the future. Well, hey, without further introduction, let's jump into this podcast with Quentin Swanson. Quentin, thanks so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Quentin, so you're chairman of the General Council for Shoalwater Bay Indian Tribe. Could you tell me a little bit about the history and the geography of this tribe? I mean, where are you all located and how long has the tribe been there?
Yeah. So the Shoalwater Bay Tribe, we are in the southwest coast of Washington. Our people have lived here for thousands of years. We're actually descendants of the Lower Chehalis and Willapa Chinookan people. And so, you know, our connection to the land and the water, it runs very deep. You know, we're on a small peninsula by the bay. Our reservation was set by an executive order in 1866 after our chief refused to sign the 1855 treaty that would have removed us, but would have given us treaty rights. So as a result of that, like I mentioned, we are an executive order tribe and we don't inherently have treaty rights. But still, we retained a piece of our homeland, started with 335 acres. We're now up to over 5,000 acres, and we've continued to live here and, you know, fish and hunt and gather shellfish, everything that our ancestors did.
I mean, that's amazing, Quentin. That's a long time on the land. So your ancestors had to have observed a lot of different things going on in the environment and like pass that knowledge on. So like, what are some of the things they observed in the seasonal cycles or just, you know, the environment in that part of the world?
Yeah. So, you know, there are stories obviously passed down from generation to generation, intergenerational knowledge, we call it. And so a lot of that was through oral tradition, daily practice. I grew up listening to elders. My own grandparents share stories that weren't only entertaining, but also were filled with teachings about, you know, living in harmony with our surroundings, with the land. You know, often those lessons came in the form of legends or anecdotes that were told around the dinner table. So for example, one of the things that I was taught was that they were very aware of the potentiality of a major flood. And so, you know, they didn't use the word tsunami per se in the old days, but the concept of a sudden dangerous flood was known, and that was actually attributed to Thunderbird. And the idea was that Thunderbird was bringing her eggs across the ocean. One of the eggs dropped into the ocean and caused a major tidal wave. Or another variation of that story is the Thunderbird and the whale story. And, you know, that's not only common in our neck of the woods, but, you know, among coastal people from Northern California all the way to Vancouver Island. And that one differs a bit in the sense that Thunderbird and whale were having a major battle. Thunderbird carried whale into the air and dropped it. And same thing, it caused the earth to shake and an ocean surge. And so there were different ways of communicating these major, you know, events that impacted our ancestors. Those are just a couple of the variations that I learned.
Quentin, are most of those stories talking about the flood that we would think of as a tsunami or as well with the shaking of the ground and the earthquake? I mean, is it both of them or more focused on the flood in your memory?
So from my understanding, that was more attributed to the Cascadia level event that happened that caused a major tidal wave in about the year 1700.
Wow. And so obviously that would have impacted the tribe. You said the tribe's been there for more than 1,000 years. So that it sounds like they experienced that, survived it, and then passed that down a lot through stories to the preceding generations.
Exactly. Yeah.
I wanted to ask too, did some of this native ways of knowing and environmental knowledge, did it come down through art, music, dance as well? Or in your experience, was it really mostly storytelling?
So how I grew up, it was mostly storytelling. We did have some level of song and dance, but not to my recollection were those sort of teachings really integrated into those form of arts.
Yeah, interesting. So it sounds like a lot of storytelling and different, you talked about around the table or, you know, hearing these stories from maybe your parents, grandparents, elders, you know, different folks that were passing on this knowledge. And you already mentioned that, you know, there's this concern about a major tsunami or coastal flood that they had experienced, and they were passing that information on. I wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about, and the reason we wanted to interview you, I came across this story that there's been a freestanding tsunami structure that's been in place that the tribe put on, I guess, knowing your risk, but then, you know, getting out ahead of this to say, okay, when this flood comes, how can we survive it? So could you tell us a story about how did this go from, you know, hearing stories to saying we have to take action and prepare for a future tsunami?
Yeah. So knowing about a danger and acting on it are two inherently different things. So for a long time, like many communities, even though we carried this knowledge and these stories of tsunamis in the back of our minds, we hadn't really done much to mitigate the potentiality of a major event like this happening. So I would say that the turning point for us came in stages. One major wake-up call was watching the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami in Japan. And I actually remember as a kid walking along Washaway Beach, and we would find different, you know, little artifacts that had Japanese engravings on it. So I remember, you know, our community talking about this, you know, watching entire towns swept away on live television, cars bobbing and swirling debris. I actually remember finding a piece of a car door on Washaway Beach, you know, on the other side of the world. So that was heart-wrenching and horrifying. And, you know, for a long time, our community has been talking about how scientists have said that that same kind of magnitude, a 9.0 Cascadia earthquake, will strike our coast someday, that it's not a matter of if, but when. And so around that same time, new research and media attention were sort of shining a light on our region's seismic risks. Perhaps you might have heard of the article, The Really Big One, that came out in 2015. There have been other articles through, you know, PBS, Frontline, things of that nature that have really shined a lot of light on this phenomenon. And so that potentiality, a 9.0 magnitude earthquake, would absolutely decimate our region. And so we started asking ourselves, you know, what can we do? We have elders, children, neighbors. How do we protect them knowing we might only have 15 to 30 minutes after an earthquake before a tsunami hits? And so we had a tribal emergency management team that was led by one of our elders, Lee Shipman. She was actually our first emergency management director. And so Lee had been talking about for years the tsunami threat and reaching preparedness. So she started ordering evacuation drills, community meetings. I remember working as a youth in our education program, and I remember these different events that she would hold that would prepare us for the event of a major disaster. And so the idea of the vertical evacuation tower was actually her brainchild, her working with FEMA, trying to figure out how can we make this happen. And a lot of our community thought that this was more of a pipe dream, but you know, Lee was very, very adamant that this is real, that this can happen, and that we need to make it happen. And so as a result of Lee's determination, that sort of fueled us, our tribal council took her recommendation seriously, and they set aside, I think it was about $1 million. And so that showed FEMA that we were serious. So altogether, the tribe put in about $2.1 million. FEMA put in about, I think it was close to $3 million. So altogether, it's about a $5 million structure. And it's the first of its kind.
Quentin, could you describe this structure? I mean, what is it? What does it look like? How would people access it? I mean, tell us what this structure looks like.
Yeah, so it's about 50 feet tall, made of stout concrete and steel with two levels of refuge platforms. The lower platform is about 33 feet above ground. The upper is about 43 feet high. And so, you know, the estimation is that the maximum wave height in our area could be around 16 feet. So to be safe, they designed it for over 20 feet.
Wow, that's tremendous. I mean, that's fast moving seawater, obviously very destructive. So like how you had mentioned before, the lead time you might have, was it around, I think you said maybe 15 to 25 minutes, 30 minutes, something like that. Yeah. How long would people have until a tsunami potentially hit?
So the estimation is about 15 to 30 minutes, 30 being on the high end. And the reason that it was sort of placed in the central location that it is so that people on either side of the peninsula could get to it. Although there is an alternative route for those on the more northern side of the peninsula, which we call Eagle Hill. And that's where we're actually looking to relocate our village. But that's a conversation for a later time. But there are two different areas. And the southern end of the peninsula, they wouldn't be able to reach Eagle Hill in time. And so this tsunami tower sort of provides an area for those who wouldn't be able to make it in an adequate amount of time.
So, Quinta, in theory, how many people could reach the site? I mean, do you have an idea of the population that could be saved by getting up on the tower?
So the estimation is that we could cram in about 400 people. That's shoulder to shoulder if needed. It wouldn't be comfortable, but that's maximum capacity. We do have about 300 people living on the Tokelon Peninsula, about 100 of which are tribal members. So the idea wasn't just to provide for our tribal members, but to all the local community. And Tokelon's actually a tourist destination. A lot of people like to come and fish and hunt. And so typically at an even time, we do have, you know, probably approaching close to 400.
That's amazing, Quentin. So the vision is really to save the tribe, but then also anyone in the area, even if you're not in the tribe, you could come and take refuge there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's say, you know, I hope it never happens, but if there is this massive earthquake, I would imagine people, the idea is immediately getting to that tower. Would most of that access be people driving to there? Would some people walk? I mean, what would accessibility or transportation look like to get to that structure immediately?
So assuming that it was a 9.0 magnitude earthquake, as I mentioned, that has the potentiality to absolutely decimate the land. We can't exactly say how things would be in a scenario like that, but keeping in mind that a lot of our ground here is sandy and prone to liquefaction, which is when the soil basically turns to quicksand during violent shaking, the design had to account for that. So the whole thing can sway a bit and handle the shaking without collapsing. The columns are made of concrete field steel. The stairs are breakaway, so if something like a big boat or something were to hit the stairs, it's not going to take the whole structure down with it. But keeping that in mind, that you know that the earth is prone to liquefaction, that is a major challenge for people to get there. So you know, I really can't say in that scenario sure how many people would be able to make it.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Obviously, I mean, who could say what would happen, where those cracks would be if you have liquefaction? Like, you know, who's to say how the soil is going to hold up, how the roads are going to hold up? It sounds like the tribe did their best though to put this in a central location where as many people as possible could reach it. It sounds like,
yeah.
Quentin, when you said potentially a 16-foot tsunami wave, is that 16 feet above ground level or is that, you know, above sea level or some other datum? Do you, like for reference, is how high would that be above ground level?
So yeah, I believe that's 16 feet above sea level. And currently our reservation in most areas is about 2 feet above sea level, 2 to 5 feet. And so this structure was keeping that in mind and is adequate for the maximum potential wave height.
Quentin, it sounds like the tribe came through and put up a lot of funds to say, we're serious. We're, you know, investing in this. We're taking ownership in this. And then it sounds like FEMA came along as well. Were there other partners or was it mostly the tribe working with FEMA?
So there were multiple partners involved. We had an engineering firm, Degen Kolb Engineers, which was led by Cale Ash, who did a lot of work with our emergency management director, Lee. They helped us sort of with the conceptual design. I believe that started in around 2018. So they sort of guided the technical side, how tall, how strong, what materials, the site. Obviously, FEMA helped out a lot. This tower is the very first FEMA-funded tsunami refuge tower in the United States. Let's see, our former chairwoman, Charlene Nelson, was a big part of it. She worked a lot with Lee. And we also had support from the Washington State Emergency Management Division and also advisors from the University of Washington.
It sounds like a lot of support. I mean, the idea, it's genius, right? It's just getting your people up, even if it's briefly. It sounds like it doesn't really need shelter. You don't need a roof. You don't need like long-term utilities. You just need to get people up for a short period of time, right? To let the water pass underneath.
Yeah, I believe that the estimate by our past emergency management director, Ken Efkin, was that it would probably take about 2 to 3 days before anyone could actually reach us. And so with that in mind, we also have it equipped with Starlink as well as ham radios so that we could reach out to the outside world and be able to communicate what's going on.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, we've seen footage of violent tsunamis that are just tearing up and destroying the entire landscape. I see what you're saying. It's going to be hard to access that site for a while, but fortunately, if the people are high enough, they're going to survive the event.
Yeah, and also we have enough materials up there to be able to adequately supply food and water for about 3 days with maximum capacity. So keeping that in mind, we don't anticipate reaching 400 people. So for the couple hundred that make it in an ideal scenario with liquefaction and all that into consideration, they'd be able to last up there for a while.
That's amazing, Quentin. I mean, it looks like the tribe has really put forethought into food, water, communication, you know, doing the best you can. And this is what we talk a lot about on our podcast. We can't stop these disasters, but how do we have foresight? How do we take action ahead of time to give ourselves the best chance of a good outcome? And it sounds like you all have done everything you can ahead of time, you know, to potentially mitigate a terrible situation. Quentin, we're in the part of the podcast called Weathered Wisdom, where we like to ask every guest, what is a weather or an environmental event that you can remember that left the biggest impression on you? It could be something that impacted you personally, something that impacted you professionally, but something maybe that shocked you, or maybe that, you know, it just left such a memory and such an impression on you that you'll never forget it.
I would say in this context, something that left a big impact on me was our 2007 storm that we had. You know, it was, I believe, in December. So the same time of the year, the massive storm system hit the Washington coast. I was pretty young then. I believe I was about 10 years old. But I remember family talking about a major storm that was coming. Nobody expected the intensity. You know, we're used to storms around here. But when it arrived, it brought this hurricane force wind and torrential rain. I remember having, you know, my grandma, several other people all at my house. We had probably 10 people crammed into our house. The power was out for, I believe it was close to 2 weeks. And we also had a lot of people gathered over in our casino, over in the gym, in order to keep warm. And trees were down, the roads were flooded, littered with debris. Nobody had any power for close to 2 weeks. We were just operating on canned goods because, you know, we didn't have access to any outside resources. Probably a weekend, we didn't have gas. And so there was no ability to get gas. Our generators were out. And that was actually part of the reason why we built our gas station just a few years later. But yeah, I remember walking out after the storm had, you know, come and gone. And it looked like a bomb went off. I mean, we had, you know, power lines hanging down. Luckily, most of the houses were okay, but.
Yeah, the power of those winter storms in the Northwest is amazing. And it sounds like this one far exceeded other ones that you had seen in your lifetime.
Right.
It's always a challenge to have these hit in the winter too, when, you know, you really want to heat your home and it's dark for much of the day. Right. So, I mean, having power is so important. It sounds like the tribe pulled together to do their best. And then even some changes afterwards, like you said, putting a gas station there and making some adjustments.
Right. And I guess one more thing I'll add that really stood out in my mind was we had Senator Maria Cantwell fly in on a helicopter and come and address our community. And so that, you know, being a young kid and seeing that, that really, impressed me.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I know a part of the world where you get a lot of storms, you get a lot of really interesting weather. Earthquakes, tsunamis, much more rare, but this is what we're talking about in the podcast today, preparing for something that we haven't seen in living memory up there, but your ancestors have passed knowledge along saying it's happened before. And I love the fact that your tribe is being proactive, getting out and taking action. Quentin, back to the tsunami structure, do you know of any structures like this in the world? I mean, you mentioned this is a first like it in the United States. Are there other structures like that in other countries? Do you know about them?
Tohoku, Japan is actually where our tsunami structure was modeled after. And, you know, I mentioned that in Japan, they had a major catastrophe in 2011. And so if you look through that region, you can find these steel and concrete towers or platforms that are designated as refuges in many villages. And so our tower closely resembles those Japanese towers.
That makes sense. You know, we all saw the footage of the 2011 Japanese tsunami. And you know what stands out to me about your story? A lot of times we see terrible things happen in other places, but we don't connect the dots. And what I see your tribe doing is saying, wait, if this happened in tsunami in Japan, we have the tsunami modeling. We know that the Cascadia fault there is a subduction fault where we could see a massive tsunami. You're connecting dots and saying, hey, what happened in Japan could happen here. And I think, I don't know if you'd agree, but, you know, there was also a massive tsunami in 2004, and it's amazing to see the technology change between those two. You know, by 2011, we have YouTube, we have a lot of streaming video, and just the amount of footage of that Japanese tsunami. It's one thing to hear about it. It's another thing to see video. It sounds like you're saying you and some of your friends and family and tribe there saw what happened in Japan and said, hey, we have to take precaution here and get out ahead. What if that happens in our neighborhood?
Exactly. And I think that that was really the wake up call. But there are a couple of more local references to look to. So prior to our tower, there were two notable tsunami refuges in the Pacific Northwest, but neither was a standalone tower. Ours is the first freestanding. But one is in Newport, Oregon, at the Oregon State University's Marine Science Center, which is essentially a reinforced roof platform on a building. And the other is actually, you know, a community that's very, very close to us in Westport, Washington, at the Acosta Elementary School. And I believe the engineers that worked on our tsunami tower also worked on that one. So they had that knowledge to bring into our project.
So it sounds like efforts have been made in different ways to have like rooftop platforms or things like this. But for your tribe, that's the only freestanding tsunami structure that was built completely for tsunami people under threat to get up, get some elevation during an actual event.
Yep, it was the first vertical evacuation structure in the U.S., and I believe now there are other communities that are looking at building something similar. I believe Ocean Shores, and now the city of Westport actually just got a grant to build something similar.
Quinta, it's a fantastic idea. Again, you're being proactive. You're envisioning what, like you said, not if it happens, it's when it happens. We know the physics are there that one day it'll happen. And it seems like, you know, your tribe is doing everything you can to get out ahead of this and prepare. Quentin, how can people find your tribe online if they're like, okay, I haven't heard of this tribe before. I want to learn more about them, about their history, about their heritage, or just, you know, whether it's about the tsunami structure or just about your lifestyle and your culture there in Southwest Washington. How can people find you guys online?
So our main website is shoalwaterbay-nsn.gov, but you can also find us on Facebook. We have a presence on LinkedIn. If you just type in Shoalwater Bay on Google, there's multiple different links there.
Well, Quentin, I so much appreciate you coming on the podcast. This, to me, is a very inspirational podcast. We're often interviewing people after disasters who say, we wish more had been done ahead of time. In this case, it's opposite. We're actually interviewing you before a potential disaster and learning about how you took precaution and preparedness. Quentin, as we wrap up the podcast, I wanted to ask you, what is like one last take-home message you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would just say that if you have fears for your community, whether it be environmental fears or the potentiality for a major disaster, don't wait. You know, at least for us, waiting would have been a recipe for disaster. And so despite the fact that there might be a lot of hesitancy, there might be, you know, the fear that such a monumental project cannot be accomplished, keep pushing, because for Showater, not only have we been able to build this tsunami tower, but now we're looking at the potentiality of relocating our village. And a lot of people chalk these ideas up to pipe dreams, but now it's happening, it's in action, and it doesn't matter if you don't have the capacity, the resources. There are plenty of people out there who want to help, whether it be state, federal, local, academic agencies. So start making those connections and just keep pushing.
Quentin, these endeavors that your tribe is doing, they're huge undertakings. I mean, is it almost like just doing step by step and just starting with small steps and then it grows from there? I mean, it's, I could see people saying, or organizations, communities, tribes saying, wow, we could never accomplish something like this. I mean, is it almost just starting with small steps, or like, how did you get started on this?
It really is. It's a piecemealing effort. Obviously, you need someone who's going to be the spokesperson and who's going to really, you know, push the idea. But it takes a team effort. And for example, our move uphill, it's estimated that it could cost up to $400 million. But now, you know, we've been talking about this since 2008, and we're 10% of the way there in terms of funding. And so it really does. It takes time. It takes effort. It takes a community. But it's, you just got to go step by step.
Thanks so much, Quentin, for taking time to come on the podcast. And I really think this is going to be an inspirational podcast for our listeners. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, Hal. And I hope you have a good day.
Well, thank you so much, Quentin, for coming on the podcast. Wow, I found this very inspirational, and I walked away with really three major take-home points. Number one, Quentin reminded us all of the power of nature. He talked about the 2011 Japan tsunami that devastated coastal Japan. And he said he found a car door with Japanese writing all the way on the Pacific coast in Washington state. It's reminded me of the violence and the extreme power of nature to devastate our communities with something like a tsunami. And, you know, the second thing that I got there was reminding us how much we're all connected. I mean, not only did this tsunami push tremendous amounts of water on the coast of Japan, but it actually floated a car door and presumably a lot of debris across the entire North Pacific Ocean all the way to the United States. We talk about how we're interconnected, but this was a really good example about how our Earth is really connected through these different ocean basins and different hazards. And lastly, obviously, the big take-home point, I think, for all of us is that we see a lot of disaster-prone communities who see a neighboring community or a community across the world hit by a hazard that could impact their community. And typically they don't take it to heart. They say, we feel bad for this other community, but thank God that'll never happen to us. In this case, Quentin and Shoalwater Bay Indian Tribe, they're looking at this and saying, wow, what happened in Japan could happen in our community. They're looking at, you know, they have a similar physical geography, but they're also looking back at the history that was given to them from their ancestors. He said Native Americans have been there for more than 1,000 years that have said there's been an earthquake, there's been a massive tsunami before. They're connecting the dots, but then it went beyond conversation to actually taking action, to creating local and state and federal government partners to build this tsunami structure. But I'm amazed by this because, again, a lot of communities don't go this far to actually take action and have foresight about mitigating against a disaster that they have not seen in living memory. We haven't seen anything over the past several hundred years in this part of the world of what they're preparing for, but they know eventually one day it's going to come. And Quentin and his tribe really went out ahead of time to really prepare and to mitigate against future losses. Very inspirational message here, a story that our disaster-prone partners really need to hear. Quentin, thank you again for coming on the podcast. Thanks to you and your tribe for being so resilient and having so much foresight to take action about a disaster you haven't seen yet, but you know one day is coming your way. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening to the GeoTrek podcast, for helping to make us one of the top podcasts on the topics of natural disasters. We so much appreciate your support and involvement with our channel. I'm your host, Hurricane Hal. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.